The first one was just a shock of fear, anticipation of the core of what is happening. So these lectures are going to be about quantum gravity, about loop quantum gravity. Right? That would be the core. What I want to do is to give you an overview of the state of the art of the loop approach to quantum gravity today. Roughly, today the problem of quantum gravity is open. There are a number of ideas out to talk with different people to get different perspectives.
Could you turn the microphone on, please? Thank you.
One. Is it on?
Hello.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're taping this, I tried online, and the volume of the sound was low. So if you can keep it higher for the online thing. Okay, so lecture number two, introduction. I'll start again for the large public around the world. The lecture is going to be about loop quantum gravity. There are today many ideas about quantum gravity, many point of view. The problem is open, but there are two theories, well developed, where you can actually write the full equation of the theory, compute thing, which in principle are observable. Both theories are incomplete. None of them give a decent theory of quantum gravity. These are string theory on the one hand and loop quantum gravity on the other hand. And what I want to give you in this, sort of 3 weeks is a general picture of the loop approach to quantum gravity, right? What is the state of the art? I will actually get to the recent things, to the things developed in the last 2 or 3 years, especially because a lot has happened in the last 2 or 3 years. So I'll try to get you an updated picture. I will not do everything. I mean, the subject is huge. There is the books. There are hundreds, thousands of papers out there. I'm not covering everything, but I will cover all the core ideas and the main some of the main applications. Let me start by just giving you some. Reference about that. I will follow basically two reference. One is my book, Quantum Gravity. In which is a few years old, so it does not have the last developments, which in a sense are the more interesting. Yes, it's a Chinese edition as well, and it has the most important part of the book is the first half, where there is the general conceptual scheme needed to, I believe, to understand a quantum theory of gravity. But then the core of the theory, which I'm going to describe, is in some lectures, which are called Zakopane, because they were given in a place in Poland called Zakopane lectures on quantum gravity, on loop quantum gravity, which not published yet. They will be published on the proceedings of the school. They're on the archives. Is 11023660. Some introductory ideas, some very simple introductory textbook, I want to put it here, sort of undergraduate level, in which there are some preliminary material where you can look if you don't know it, is a book, A First Course in Loop Quantum Gravity. A First Course in LQG by Gambinian pooling. It's very well done, it's very simple, and it has a lot of the basic things. Okay, so let me now do the opposite of the first lecture. Instead of plunging into calculation and giving you results, let me just spend a few moments to give you the general picture. And please come in, interrupt, comment, ask questions, because I want this to be as possible. Do objection if you. I'll be general, but I will not say things which are uncontroversial. So I will just give you a specific point of view and some core ideas, which I think are needed to understand what's going to happen. So why studying quantum gravity? Why quantum geometry? Why this quanta of space that I gave you in the first lecture? Where do they come from? Where are we? So the first question is, what do we know today about nature at the elementary level of physics? We know only a few things. We know quantum mechanics, including its infinite dimensional applications in quantum field theory. And of course, its classical limit, which is classical mechanics. This is a spectacularly good theory, which, for the moment, has worked always perfectly. And there doesn't seem to be any empirical indication that is wrong. Of course, it has its own confusion and difficulty of understanding, but it's believable as something we know about the world, at least so far up to new indications. Then we know the standard model, which sort of SU3 process you do cross U1, which also, I mean, it sort of has bad press. People always say how ugly it is. In reality, it's probably the most successful physical theory ever, maybe even more than electromagnetism, Maxwell theory, or Newton theory. It has spectacularly good prediction. It works spectacularly well. It's full of details that nobody believed, and nature has keep saying it's right. We're going to see what happened with the Higgs from CERN. Everybody's sort of waiting for the, but even the Higgs, which seemed the less believable part of it, seems to be there. So it works spectacularly well. And then, of course, we know general relativity. Which in the last few years, few decades, has changed its status dramatically. When I was your age, which is not so much time ago, I studied general relativity, and basically there was no experiment supporting it, except two or three sort of called classic tests. And the people doing general relativity were a little bit outside mainstream physics, seen as little nutty people doing funny things. Talk about black holes, curved space times, which seemed absurd to the rest of the physical community. In the last two decades, a number of experimental verification of general relativity has exploded enormously. Now black holes within the sky. We have indirect evidence, very strong, that gravitational waves exist. The Nobel Prize of binary pulsar, etc., etc. There's cosmology, etc., etc., etc. So now general relativity is completely mainstream physics. It's taken very seriously, including its funny things about curved space-time and black holes and so on. Now, I want to, why I'm saying that you know, because I want to insist that this is the only thing we know about the world, right? Nothing more. Everything else, like loop quantum gravity, like supersymmetry, like unified theory, like string theory, like higher dimension, and whatever, is just speculations. We have no idea whether it's right or wrong. Okay? This is important because being immersed in the research community, one sometimes loses the sense of reality and is not able to distinguish what we know from what we dream. It's good to dreaming. Each one of these theories were dreams before becoming credible theories. But a lot of other dreams didn't go anywhere. Many. When I was your age, a student, the standard model was not in place. Everybody was doing bootstrap and whatever. Everybody was doing, obviously, quantum field theory is wrong. We have to abandon quantum field theory to do something else to understand the strong interactions. And it was just all bullshit. It didn't work. Okay? So there can be big communities enormously taken by some ideas, including loop quantum gravity, other things, where you spend years and years and years studying some theories, which just then are forgot and abandoned. And so let's keep clear what it's credible. It doesn't mean it's definitive, of course. I mean, change, learn more, learn better, like learn better than classical mechanics, we learn better than Newton theory, and so on and so forth. But this is what nature has said, yes, it's the right track. Everything else, nature hasn't seen yet at all. Okay. In fact, there have been, I mean, there is a grand unified theory, which is SU5, which when came out, which is a way of unifying all interaction except gravity, when it came out, was so beautiful, so natural, so clear, so credible that everybody was convinced that this was the case. Okay? Except that it predicts proton decay at a certain rate, and people look for the proton decay, and the proton does not decay at that rate. So it was just wrong. SU5 is not the correct theory of nature. Maybe SU10, maybe something else, but that's not the case. So all the rest, this is the message, the speculation. Has to be done, otherwise we don't go ahead, but has not to be taken for granted at all. We don't know if there are quantum space, we don't know if there's supersymmetry, we don't know if there's strings, we don't know if there are dimensions. But many of these ideas could be wrong. Okay, so however, to look beyond that, we have hints and we have indications. And what are the open problems beyond this? So why are we not happy with just this picture there? Because there are open problems, and what are they? Well, there are two kinds, empirical experiments and theoretical. Now, typically, if you look at the history of science, the usual situation in science is that you have a lot of experiments that you don't understand. It just don't fit with the theory you have. That was what happened in physics most of its history. Not always, but most of its history. For instance, again, 20 years ago when I was studying, there were all the so-called resonances, the particles of, seen in detectors of strong interaction. There was this particle data book with all this, and nobody had any idea of how to order all that. It was this mess of empirical data and total confusion. Okay? Zero. So an enormous amount of data without a theory. Then Gell-Mann, SU3, a standard model came, and everything just fell into order. Just a few quarks, and everything seems to work wonderfully. So what are the data today which we don't understand? Well, almost none. We are in a very peculiar moment of the history of science when this set of theories there is so powerful that, in principle, it predicts everything we can observe. Okay, these with appropriately, so generativity with a cosmological constant, the standard model with a neutrino mass, and you get everything. There are very little, very few indications that something is clearly missing. Perhaps the only real one is dark matter. Dark matter, it seems credible that it's not made by baryons, the stuff described in the standard model. So if that's correct, there is something else outside this picture that we haven't seen. But basically, that's it. Nothing really else. Which, again, doesn't mean that this picture is complete. For instance, dark energy is perfectly described by cosmological constant and general relativity. A lot of people say, well, it should be something else. But that picture describes it. So it might be that that picture has to be changed, but nothing clearly points out that we have to. On the other hand, there are big theoretical problems, and there are two problems which are important to distinguish. One is that that picture is incomplete. And the second is that picture is sort of ugly and fragmented. But the two things has nothing to do with one another. So let me start from the second one. Okay? A lot of people think that this is too much an ugly picture for the world. Generativity is described completely different than the standard model. The standard model itself is a patchwork with all this constant inside. So there should be some unified picture. So there is a huge drive in physics toward unification. And so the problem is unification. Okay. Beautiful idea of trying to go toward unification is string theory, which sort of aims of giving a simple global picture where all that comes as bits of the story. Okay? A different problem is to complete the picture, because the picture itself is incomplete. Why it is incomplete? Because generativity is a classical theory, we don't have its quantum description. Okay? Which means that there are simple physical facts that about which we have that set of theory give no prediction whatsoever. Let me give you an example. Suppose you scatter two particles, okay, to neutral particle, which interact only gravitationally. What happens, suppose they just attract one another and they bounce away from one another. So at low energy, you forget quantum mechanics, and generativity gives you exactly what happens. In fact, at super high energy also, you can forget quantum mechanics, because at super high energy, what happens is that they fall into black hole. They form a black hole. So generativity works very, very, very well. But if you plot the possible regimes and put the center of mass energy here and the impact parameter here, so how close they come to one another, how well they aim at one another, it's not a complicated calculation to show that here at low energy, at fixed impact parameter, you can just use you can start computing quantum correction using perturbative quantum generativity, quantum GR, okay? And it works because you use an effective field theory, just standard methods of quantum field theory. If you don't go too much high in energy, you can just renormalize, fix just a few parameters, and so you can use quantum field theory, and you have a prediction, which is very credible. At very high energy, there's black holes that form, so it's a black hole. So you can use classical GR, it works, but there is a region where in Planck units, so in units C equal H bar equal G equal 1, a region in which the impact parameter and the center of mass energy have comparable, similar to one another, in these units here, where we have no idea whatsoever of what happens. So you scatter two things, and nothing there tells you a number of where they go, zero. So you click a hole there. And in fact, it's not just that. Scattering. If you take cosmology, you all know, you go back in time, the universe was very hot and very dense. The energy density was very high. So when the energy density is at the level of Planck energy density is at level 1 in these units here, generativity doesn't make any sense anymore, and the theory just disappears. Generativity develops singularities. So we have no idea. So early cosmology. And so on. There's something in physics of black holes, there's something about physics of very small dimensions, the things of which those theories don't tell us anything. Okay? So clearly, independently of the unification, okay, there is a question just how to complete this model. Now, it might be that the only possibility to complete, to find that, is to go to a unification, okay, and that's what string theorists often think, but it might not be. I mean, QCD, the SU3 series, a perfectly complete, coherent, consistent theory of this quantum properties of strong interactions without being a unified theory with the rest. Okay? So it might very well be that generativity, or gravitational phenomena, can be described with their quantum properties without the need of going to a unification theory. And the aim of doing that, it's quantum gravity. So writing a quantum field theory for the gravitational interaction, forgetting unification and just for aiming at computing everything there. Now, why these numbers? Well, obviously, if you are doing relativistic physics, you are in regimes in which velocity is order one. If you are doing quantum physics, the regime is expected to be in regimes where the action is the order of h bar. And if you are in a gravitational regime, you expect not to neglect the Newton constant. So that's the scale at which you expect quantum gravitational phenomena. This can be do a little bit more precisely. You probably have seen that in the following way. And this thought gives you the intuition of what is quantum gravity about. Suppose you have a region L, a region of size L. And suppose you want to measure it, and you want to have particles that check this region, which are smaller than that. And this particle will have a quantum wavelength, lambda, and you want lambda to be the order or smaller than L. Now, because of quantum mechanics, the wavelength is h. Is of the order of the h bar of the momentum. Okay? And because of general relativity, p is the order of the energy. And because of special relativity, the energy is the order of the mass. And because of general relativity, if you have a mass, you have a gravitational field around. And if the region, if the mass is concentrated in the small region, you create a black hole. And the radius of the black hole generated by a mass m is 2gm, according to general relativity. This is standard basics general relativity. So what you want is that this length that you're measuring is larger than the Schwarzschild radius, because otherwise, if you try to measure inside its own Schwarzschild radius, you just don't see it anymore because there's an event horizon around it. Okay? So you want L to be larger than the Schwarzschild radius, which is, forget the two, we're just giving order of magnitudes, Gm, which is G using this P, and P is h bar of lambda. But lambda is the size of the region you want to look at. So is L. So what you get is L square must be larger than GH bar. And GH bar is a length square in C equal 1. All this is in C equal 1, which is called the Planck length. Planck length is the order of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So what's in physics here? If this is semi-classical, nothing rigorous here, it's intuition from generativity quantum mechanics. If you squeeze too much energy in a small region, you create a black hole. On the other hand, if you don't have too much energy, quantum wavelength is too large, so you have a large region. If you bring the two together, you cannot. So if you try to look smaller than a Planck scale, you fall into your own black holes. This is suggesting that there's no physics beyond the Planck length scale. Okay? And somehow space stops there. And the calculation that you saw yesterday is a calculation that goes exactly in that direction, right? If you take a piece of space and you consider quantum mechanics and you assume those commutation relations that I wrote yesterday, then you get to a minimal size. So reality goes down to a minimal size. There's nothing beyond that minimal size. Okay. Sort of Greek, old Greek atomic theory applied to space itself. Right. Like, then the idea, that's the core idea of quantum gravity. Special relativity, we learn that the velocity of objects gets to c. Quantum mechanics, we learned that the minimal action that you can exchange between things is h bar. So no phenomenon, there's no phenomenon of sort of half h bar action. In quantum gravity, what seems to be saying this kind of intuitive arguments is that there's no physics beyond the Planck scale, smaller than the Planck scale. And the calculation I gave you yesterday is a little hint of that. In fact, the full theory of quantum gravity then realizes that. And notice that if this is correct, nothing important happens. And this happens both in string theory and in loop quantum gravity, that the fundamental theory of the world, in terms of length, has a scale. There's a scale, which is a Planck scale. And in loop quantum gravity, you really have bits of space like that. The area is quantized. But in string theory also, because string theory, there is no, string theory is finite. It's finite. Doesn't, you don't renormalize your h-bar, high order in h-bar relative corrections. Which means that there is no critical phenomenon behind string theory. There is no scaling. There's really a scale, which in string theory is given by the string constant, the string tension, which essentially is a Planck scale. Okay? If you want an analogy, you're also studying condensed matter. Condensed matter is a theory where you have an atomic, molecular scale, and the macroscopic scale. And you study two different kinds of phenomena. You study critical phenomena, where what happens at the macroscopical scale is independent of the microphysics. And then you study all the rest of the phenomena, which are not critical phenomena, where the macroscopic scale depends on the microphysics. And quantum field theory, QED and also QCD, are based on the idea that you want to look at nature as it was on a critical phenomena. There's no minimal scale down there. You have quantum field theory, you have infinite number of degrees of freedom for arbitrary small scales. This idea seems to go wrong in quantum gravity, both if you think at string and if you think at loop quantum gravity. So quantum gravity is like condensed matter, but away from criticality. Okay? Like condensed matter. Away from criticality. Unlikely quantum field theory, where you have an infinite renormalization. So here you expect not to have an infinite renormalization. Of course, things will scale, there will be a renormalization from Planck scale up, but not an infinite one. All right, so what do we know about quantum gravity then? How many theories do we have, and why we don't have a theory already? Well, let me give you rapidly the history of the thing in just a few words, because it has been long and long turnaround. If you have questions, just jump in. Don't hesitate. Yes?
I think you said that quantum gravity is acting as meta over criticality. Do you have some parameter that regulates, like, how? Do we have any parameter that regulates how away are we from criticality, and can we actually arrive to a critical point?
No. I think that in quantum gravity you forget the idea of critical points. Just don't think about that. If you have to describe a piece of iron starting from the molecular scale, you just, there are no critical points, unless you're at some temperature.
So we have no parameter like temperature, yeah?
No.
So how does that correspond to the idea of human thermogenesis?
Of?
Human thermogenesis, or the thing that some people in quantum gravity propose.
There are different ways of thinking about that. geometry is, in general relativity, is Riemannian geometry. Riemannian geometry is a classical gravitational field. Clearly, at the quantum level, this should not be the case, right? It should be something else. So, in the picture that I gave you yesterday, this intuitive picture, you have individual quanta of space, which obviously are not compatible with Riemannian geometry. There's nothing granular in Riemannian geometry. So you can talk about geometrogenesis in the sense in which you go from these individual quanta up macroscopically to a... but this is...
But you wouldn't expect a critical point from that, right?
No. No. I mean, if you have a box with an electromagnetic field, pure, without electrons, pure, then you have individual quanta. Each mode is quantized. So you can describe the state of the box, saying that there are bits of energy that go around. If the energy is sufficiently large, if there are sufficiently many photons around, there is a continuous description in terms of electromagnetic field. There's no critical phenomenon here. Zero. Okay, so just very rapidly, the idea that you should quantize the gravitational field goes back to Einstein, right? In 1910, Einstein already realized that you should quantize the gravitational field even before writing general relativity. But it's only in the 30s, 1930s, of course, that people realized that gravitational field is special with respect to quantization. The person who realized it is Bronstein. A young, young because it was killed young, a Russian, friend of Landau, who was killed by the Stalin police in a young age. And the story is interesting. Landau suggested that quantum field theory, this is before quantum field theory, right, would break out with quantum mechanics because the field itself is not observable in a point. So the field is not a good observable. That was an observation by Landau. And Bohr protested and said, no, 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 you're not understanding quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics works very well for fields, and the field in a point isn't observable. It's not going to commute with something else, but it isn't observable. Okay? And then there was some beautiful and well-known papers by Bohr and others, who, Roosevelt, who actually showed that in quantum mechanics the field is observable, so Landau was wrong. But Bronstein, friend of Landau, was discussing that with Landau, realizes that the Bohr analysis of the observability of the field does not work in the case of gravity, and so understood that gravity's generativity is different in something, so the field in a point becomes non-observable because of the gauge invariance of GR, etc., etc., and is the first one who realized that something funny happens at space and time. In quantum gravity. So Einstein realized it. And then it had to wait the 50s with John Wheeler, DeWitt, Feynman, Fadev, a lot of other people. Meissner, Charles Meissner is one of the first people who actually start studying quantum gravity seriously, and very soon the researchers' quantum gravity split in two parts. One part, which was sort of based on the idea of let's forget what's special about general relativity, let's not look at special relativity as a gravitational theory, as a geometrical theory, which is possible, and split the metric, right, g mu nu, which is a field, a function of S, in a flat metric or a fixed metric plus some variation. And let's just sort of quantize this one and do a standard quantum field theory. And then you know the story. This is the theory is non-renormalizable. There was a lot of work by Feynman, Toft, Veltman. In fact, the normalization of the standard model came out as a side product of the attempt to define renormalized general relativity. Toft and Veltman were working on GR, and they did the normalization of Young-Mills theory as a warm-up exercise to do GR. The theories don't really normalize. Also, the series is bad. And therefore, the attempt was to change the theory. Change the theory, why? Because basically because of the analogy with the weak interaction. Like Fermi theory is no normalizable, GR is no normalizable. Fermi theory was corrected by going to the Weinberg-Salam theory, adding field, make a more complicated theory. So maybe the same should happen with GR. And there were a lot of modifications of the theory of GR studied for a long time. R square modifications, supersymmetry came here, supersymmetry and supergravity. I mean, nothing worked. There was some moment of great excitement that supersymmetry would make the theory finite, but it didn't work. So all sorts of ideas, and finally this ended up into string theory, which is sort of finite solution of a problem in the sense it is a finite, more normalizable, finite theory of quantum gravity, except it has its own problems in 10 dimensions and not in 4, and nobody knows how to really go down to 4. It has supersymmetry, and so they seem to be saying there's no supersymmetry. We don't know. Maybe it's the right solution, maybe it's not the right solution, but this is one attempt and big way of trying to write a quantum theory of gravity with its own problems. The other direction was not to do this split, and in fact, take seriously the problems, the specific problems raised by general relativity and the fact that the gravitational field is a metric. Which implies what? Implies that by itself, the gravitational field you can just view as a gravitational field. The point is that it's not that the gravitational field is a metric. The point is that it's a metric, it's a gravitational field. So if the metric is a gravitational field, and the metric itself becomes a quantum field, so you don't have a metric anymore. Unless you bring it artificially, and you use this as a metric, so you use this for defining the computational relation and so on. Here, if you want to quantize the full generativity, so quantize the full space-time, what you are forced to do is a quantum field theory which is not defined on a metric manifold, but is defined on a much weaker structure, just on the differential manifold. And the traditional approach are two. One is to write a wave function of a matrix, and the other one is to write a path integral, integrating of all geometries. And both developed, they both found difficulties. I'm not going into the full story. The wave function is supposed to satisfy an equation, which is the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Have you heard about the Wheeler-DeWitt equation? Which was written in the 60s by Wheeler. So the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. It's a beautiful equation in the sense of all of quantum gravity, except that it's badly defined. Nobody can do calculation in it. It's just infinities. And here is all the work of Hawking and his group in the 70s. The situation changed in the late 80s when Ashtekar introduced a reformulation of general relativity in terms of a connection. And suddenly, solutions to the Wheeler-DeWitt emerged. And with the Ashtekar variable, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation was reformulated. And that was the origin of loop quantum gravity in the 80s. And in the 90s, essentially, from loop quantum gravity, the quantization of geometry, it took 10 years, was proven, which is essentially the calculation that I gave you yesterday. The result is 94. The original paper is horrendously complicated. No SU2, infinitely more complicated. The version I gave you is a much later, much simplified version of this calculation due to Andrea Barbieri, in the late 90s. And these states of geometry that I describe you, in which the quantum number of spins and eigenvalues are volume of volume, are what are called spin networks. I'll describe that in detail in the course. Spin networks. In the meanwhile, the combination of the idea of writing a covariant sum of a geometries with loop quantum gravity gave rise to a sort of well-defined version of the Hawking integral, which is a spin form theory. Which I'll describe in detail. And here we are again in the 90s. And the spin form theory and the spin network theory of loop quantum gravity combined only about 5 or 6 years ago, producing a single theory, which is covariant loop quantum gravity, sort of loop quantum gravity today, covariant. The main equations of this theory and the proof that it goes to generativity in the classical limit and that its amplitude are finite are in the last, all in the last, I would say, from 2008 to today. Here in perimeter, there's a lot of people who contribute to that. Lee Smalling was crucial at this stage. Laurent Fidel was crucial in the writing of the theory now considered, so on and so forth. Eugenio Bianchi, who is a postdoc here, was crucial in analyzing this theory. So this is the overall picture. And I want to add something to this does not move. And that does not move. So I want just one idea of what has changed to that, just to give you the sense of why, and that will be the end of this story, why it's complicated and what is really going on. Think about our picture of the world. We started with Newton, worked so fantastically. And Newton's idea was that you have the particles moving into space. And it's really Newton that introduced the idea of a fixed space in which things are, right? Against Descartes, against the physics of before, and moving in time. And then the picture changed with Faraday and Maxwell. Because they realized that it's not just particles, so it's also fields. And the great intuition of Faraday is that to think about the world, you should think that there are real stuff, which are fields, magnetic field and magnetic field. So the particles sort of split in two, the matter, into actual particles and fields. Plus space, plus time. Then comes Einstein, of course, Einstein version 1905, and realize that space and time, you really cannot separate them. You should better think in terms of a single object, which is space-time. So the picture simplifies. You still have particles. You still have fields. But there's just one Minkowski space-time in which things are. Then two different things happened in parallel. One is general relativity. So Einstein again, but 10 years later. And what he realized? He realized that the space-time, Newtonian space-time, in fact, is nothing else but one of the fields. Right? It's just a gravitational field. So forget about space-time. You have a gravitational field, you have an electromagnetic field, maybe other fields, and particles. So this disappears, merges with that. So you have particles plus fields. And that's it. Space-time is just one of the fields. And in parallel, quantum mechanics shows, take the electromagnetic field, that in fact it has a granular structure. It's made by photons. And vice versa, you take an electron. In fact, you should describe it as the excitation of a quantum field. So in fact, between a photon and an electron, there isn't much difference, if not some details of statistical properties. So particles and fields are really one object, which are quantum field, whose excitations are particles. And now our job is to bring together quantum mechanics with generativity, which means that in quantum gravity, space-time is just one of the fields. So in quantum mechanics, you have quantum fields on space-time. Right? When you do quantum field theory, special relativistic quantum field theory, you start with Minkowski space and you put fields over it. In quantum gravity, the space-time is one of the fields. So you just have a single entity, which is quantum fields. And that's it. So the simplification of the world has been dramatic in going to quantum gravity. There's just a single entity, which is a quantum field, which is the same, whose excitations are at the same time the electron, the photon, and the quanta of space, which build up space. Just one single object. The quanta of this theory are not supposed to live in space-time. They are space-time themselves. Okay? Why it is difficult? Well, because of that. This is the reason of the difficulty. The reason of the difficulty is exactly the fact that basically you have to change your way of thinking everything. So this is the last comment of the day. Why of the lecture? Why difficult? Why people have not been able to do that since in 50 years? Why we don't have a complete coherent theory yet? Because there's no space-time anymore. And if there's no space-time, it means, for instance, that Hamiltonian mechanics, which is evolution in time, doesn't make any sense. It means that quantum mechanics, which is Schrödinger equation evolving in time, which also quantum field theory is the same, right? You have a unitary representation of the Poincaré group, so you have evolution in time, doesn't work any. So no background, no fixed, no standard space-time means that we have to rethink all the basics of physics. We cannot just close our eyes and use standard idea of physics, say, okay, there should be Hamiltonian, theory should be unitary. What Hamiltonian? There's no time. There's no time in classical generativity. Okay, time is very complicated in classical generativity, very different than. But you have space-time, we have pseudo-Riemannian, we have a clear understanding. It took 40 years to clear the conceptual meaning of general relativity, classical. Now, to do quantum space-time as a dynamical object is a complicated process, so we are still deeply immersed into it. So therefore, necessarily is a sort of big conceptual revolution to do quantum gravity. We have to rethink the basis, what is space, what is time, everything. And so in these 3 weeks, I sort of try to bring you through this revolution, at least ready to come for the revolution. Questions? Comments, doubts, worries.
Question. So you're saying that we have to abandon time and so on, but isn't the quantum gravity, at least in the original setting, described by Hamiltonian evolution?
No, it's going to be a generalization of Hamiltonian theory. There would not be a Hamiltonian evolving in time. Be some complicated constrained things which are going to. Yes?
But when we want to test the theory, don't we have to translate whatever comes out from that into our perception of the world, where we have time, and when we perform measurements in the world, we get time as a quantity to distinguish events, for example.
No, I think we have to develop a conceptual scheme which is larger than this, and doesn't require a fixed notion. Let me give you an example. We have an intuitive understanding of the world in which there's up and down. Right? This is the up and this is the down. And our intuitive initial structure of the world is that there's the up and there's down. Then we learn Newtonian mechanics. In Newtonian mechanics, there's no up and down. Okay? So we learn that in the world, there's no up and down. And of course, we understand that what we mean by up and down is that we live on a planet and down is toward the planet, up is the other. So it's not incompatible with our experience. But what we call up, it means just away from the big gravitational thing that attracts us. Okay. So it's not that there's no up and no down. We cannot walk on the ceilings. It means that in the fundamental equations of the world written by Newton, we don't need to talk about up and down. In fact, we cannot talk about up and down. It's not part of the story. So in the fundamental equation of quantum gravity, which I'm going to write, there's no a T with respect to evolve. There will be transition amplitude between observables. And then, of course, case by case, if we want to make an experiment here, we are going to identify some of these variables with the position of my handle of the clock, so what we call time here. So it's not that time suddenly disappears. It's not that it's at the middle of next week lectures, everybody will be frozen and not moving in time, of course. Time, we live in time in the same sense in which we live in something which has an up and down. But we can step back and write general equations in which sort of this time doesn't play any special role, it's just get one of the variables confused with the other one. Well, we'll see that in great detail how this happens.
But if you have something happening at the microscopic level, don't you need to parameterize that by something?
Like yes.
And isn't that then some kind of time parameter? Which might not be the same as the macroscopic one, but...
Yes, there will be something which can be later, in case by case, identified with time. Right. Already, when you go to Newton theory to Lorentz and to special relativity, right? Suddenly we don't have just one time, we have many times. Okay, all the Lorentz time are all equally time. Okay, you have a lot of variables related to one another by t prime is equal gamma t plus, which are all times. Which one is a good time? Well, we have many. So you already have to enlarge your way of thinking by allowing different Lorentz times equally good. When you go to general relativity, you have to further enlarge your way of thinking by considering time something more. We'll see exactly how it will work. In fact, the next lecture is physics without time. Tomorrow morning, I'll just... And classical physics. I'll try very elementary classical physics, how to think about the usual physics. Like, you know, up and down, you can rethink it in a language which doesn't know about up and down, it's a rotational invariant. So you can take usual physics and rethink it without giving time any special role.
In this picture, you said kind of with GR, we get rid of space-time and make it part of a field. But we've kind of turned, I guess, the geometric aspects of space-time into a field. But we still have the underlying manifold topology where we define everything. Do you think that'll be gotten rid of in quantum gravity, or will there still...
Very good. Very good. In fact, what happens in general relativity is two things. One is that you take the metric of space-time and you interpret it as a field. But then you're saying, okay, right, but this is a metric of a differentiable manifold, so I still have this differentiable manifold down there. Now, in general relativity, there's a second thing that happens, which is that the equations are generally covariant, are invariant under arbitrary transformations. So in fact, they are invariant and arbitrary displacement of your fields over the manifold. This is a gauge, which essentially what it does, it erases the physical meaning of the manifold entirely. So if we had a mathematical theory capable of treating that, we don't have, and if we would give a gauge invariant description of GR, which probably wouldn't even be useful, we could forget the manifold. What we really have is a space of the Riemannian matrix. About the global topology, it's a more complicated question, which we can get later to the end of the story. I can anticipate that I don't think that focusing on the global topology is very much useful. It's more of a nuisance than the core of what we need to define the theory.
But obviously, it seems that if you have your geometry being something with, say, different genus, something having totally different topology.
Genus?
I mean, if you have your manifold would have some holes in it,
yeah.
Then obviously there is some physical meaning to something like that.
Yeah, but yes, but the picture about quantum, the intuitive picture about quantum gravity, when you go into small, the metric fluctuates widely. So the notion of the global topology is something that is born only when you go up and you smooth out the in the small. The intuitive picture of Wheeler is that you have a form, you have a fluctuation of all possible topologies down there. So reverse the story. Imagine that I have a piece of paper, okay? And I ask, what is the topology of this piece of paper? Well, it's very simple, it's just a piece of R2, it's a disk. But let's go down at the smaller level, and there's a molecular scale. Now, when we go down to the molecular scale, a lot of things attach one another. It's a very complicated object with the thickness, all sort of holes, all sort of... what happens to the topology? Well, it's not just the relevant notion to describe what happens to the molecular scale. So imagine that space is made by individual quanta, which are attached to one another. Okay, and then if you have many of them, and if you can approximate the structure with a continuous thing, with a continuous thing, then you can start talking about global topology. But at a very small scale, the only thing which you have is the graph, and this will be the graph underlying the spin network, the graph which gives the connectivity of one with the other. And given a graph, you don't have any other topology than the one itself that defines the graph. Well, we'll see that in...
So maybe a connected question to that. So is there a way of getting this global topology from the covariant of quantum gravity in some...
Yes.
Semi-classical limit.
Yes, because there would be a way of writing in the state space of the theory states which are semi-classical, which are like clearance states. And once you have clearance state, each one of them is given by a semi-classical, so by a metric, which will have its own topology.
So could you have some kind of transitions, topology to change transitions? Right?
Between those states?
Yes.
Yeah, sure. And that's why I'm saying it's not that the... topology change is not existing in the series. It's more of a nuisance and a complication in the analysis of the theory. I think that focusing too much on topology change is like looking at one very particular sector of the theory before having the theory. So it's not that these things don't exist. It's not going to be exist in the theory. Is that they're going to be peculiar aspect of some transition. In this integral here, in a sense, yes, we're going to integrate over metrics which have different topologies. But there's a two-dimensional, in fact, it's not by chance that you said genus, because genus characterizes topology in two dimensions. When you're in two dimensions, topology is crucial, okay? It's just, in a sense, almost all what remains. In three or four dimensions, when you divide the space of the metric by the diffeomorphism, it's not just you get topology. You get topology and all the rest. And when we do gravitational experiments, usually we care about all the rest, not about the global topology. So topology change will be there in the theory, but is not what gives us the force and gives us the first quantum correction. So, we're at the end. So, third lecture will be again completely different in style. We'll go back to write equations and not words. And I'll go back to classical mechanics. So third lecture is mechanics without time, and how to think about classical mechanics without using the notion of time at all. Time is there, but it's not. You see exactly how it works, which will give the general scheme out of which then we can do quantum mechanics without time, and then in this language we are going to write general relativity. And in a few lectures, I mean, the other thing I could do is to just write down the basic equations of loop quantum gravity. But then, just funny white on the blackboard, what does it mean? So I'm going to build up and go there step by step, but we will arrive at writing the basic equation in a week or so. Okay?